Okay, thank you. To set the tone for the meeting, I will read an extract from A Vision for You, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. And the topic of tonight's meeting is working step 11 with the sponsee, and Tim will share anything between 30 and 45 minutes on the topic, after which the floor will be open for questions rather than the typical sharing. And with that, I will now hand over to Tim.
Tim Alcoholic, very glad to be here. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Otherwise, I'll just be talking to myself. Step 11, I think, is tricky for all sorts of reasons. I knew someone around 28 years ago in AA who was very good. He was about 8 years sober at the time, and he was very spiritual and did all sorts of remarkable spiritual things and went on retreats. And whenever he shared, it was always about his spiritual path and all of these wonderful things he was doing, and books and courses and enlightenment and all that sort of stuff. But he drifted away from AA, which he sort of saw as a starting point for the spiritual journey. And he, as it were, graduated, and poor old thing ended up in the drink. And I think that did for him. So he had some other medical conditions which weren't helped by the drinking. And that's not an unusual story. People who are sober longer than me have said that in AA, we lose as many people out of the top, if not into career and romance and money and materialism, into spiritual paths and religion. And I have seen that happen. And it is wonderful until, of course, you have a little drink. and then so much for the chanting at that point or whatever else you're doing. So there's a great difficulty there, but it's very attractive, all of that sort of stuff. And I find it very attractive, and I've gone a long way in the direction of religion and spirituality. But in my case, the cart very easily comes before the horse, and I can forget what it's about. And at the other end of the scale as well, when you've got, there's very good sponsees who want to do everything, they do want to do everything right, they want to do the program right, and they have a problem. They say, right, I'm going to up my prayer and meditation. And again, the danger can be that one amplifies the self-absorption, the absorption with one's own spiritual path. Now, of course, step 11 is a bit of a damp squib, really, compared to, gurus and retreats and Goa and Nepal or whatever these destinations are. There was a wonderful, those fake ladybird books, like there were those children's books introducing children to various aspects of the world, or ladybird books. And they've done a number of parody ones in the last few years. And one of them was the Ladybird Book of Meditation. And there was a picture, and it was always sort of fake 1970s illustrations. Remember the sort of style of illustrations of children's books in the 1970s. And it was, I won't get the caption right, but it was something like, Susie was very upset to discover a Buddhist center opening round the corner in Chiswick when she hoped her boyfriend was going to pay for a trip to Thailand for her. And the thing is about step 11, as it was written in the big book, and there's a bit of AA history there. So AA comes, for better or for worse, from a form of so-called first century Christianity, which is non-doctrinal, but very definitely Christian. So non-doctrinal in that, you know, if you're an, whether you were sort of high Anglican or an Episcopalian, they weren't too bothered. I think they raised their eyebrows a little bit at Catholics. But the point was, is to have a direct relationship with God, to get direct guidance. So it was not about exalted emotional states or states of consciousness. It was about getting direct, concrete, clear guidance about what to do. And so step 11 is very disappointing if you're on a spiritual path, because it says praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. And so when directing, and also the other thing about, so at one end of the scale, you've got these very, very keen sponsees that want to invest a lot in their spiritual life. And then you've got people at the other end of the scale that you know, wouldn't know the higher power if it stood up in their soup, and don't really care for any of that woo-woo stuff. They sort of rather pour scorn on it. And being a bit of a chameleon, I flip myself between those two extremes. So 1 minute very attractive and the other minute rather sort of off put by it all. And so at the other end of the extreme, other end of the scale, you've got sponsees who don't want anything to do with spirituality in the ordinary sense of the word in the language, and they're not interested in meditation in its current meaning. And I think the antidote for both categories, and therefore for everyone in between, is simply to stick very, very closely to the wording. So sought to improve our conscious contact with God. Now, I'll come to the word improve there, because people make great play of it. Improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, it talks in step 10 about having entered the world of the spirit. And it talks in step 12 about having a spiritual awakening, and the most important fact of our lives is the consciousness of the presence of God and all that sort of stuff. And as I said, I think in an earlier week, conscious contact with God, I don't think, or it can be conscious contact with a being. Sometimes people sense a being, but it doesn't need to be that. It means contact in my consciousness. So when I'm aware either of the knowledge of God's will for me, when I'm suddenly clear about what I need to do in a situation, and it just comes as a bolt from the blue, or when I feel sufficient resources to do that, I literally have conscious contact with God, or at least with the commodities that come from God. So this can all be pitched in a way which is palatable to people that have a problem with God and religion and spirituality. It's very, very practical. It's about the business end of the relationship with God, about what God wants me to do today. Bob D is very good on all of this. If you can catch, I don't know which talk, but I've heard him say it on a number of occasions about the dangers of going too far into the other spiritual paths, and saying when he gets off track, he remembers he has to do that other stuff in addition to. I'm not saying don't do it. If you want to go and do whatever religious or spiritual things and knock yourself out, but one does it in addition to step 11 in the book, not instead of. And it comes under the heading of, there are many useful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi, and be quick to see where religious people are right. And there are other points in the big book where it does point you towards, you know, go and rejoin your local religious or spiritual community. But I think that's absolutely right, that the core of it is this knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. So what do I do with sponsees? Well, first of all, I explain all that, which is the premise behind it, and all the other stuff, which does alter your consciousness and raise your consciousness and establish a sense of safety and identity in God or purpose in God or value in God, is all very, very good. But I've got a friend in Bristol. I won't say his name because, well, I shouldn't really. That's why. But he sticks very, very closely to this notion, and he's sober a very long time, very closely to this notion of God being good, orderly direction. It's a very British way of looking at it, I think, good, orderly direction. And there's a chap in Somerset, I know, he's sort of 45, 50 years sober, who's very similar, very, very practical, doesn't talk about God at all. But my friend in Bristol reports him as saying, whenever he sees this chap in Somerset, his car is always full of newcomers. And I think that's the best demonstration of spirituality, is people are on the phone the whole time. My friend Melody, when I was new, whenever you said, "Melody, can we go for a coffee?" She said, "Well, no, I'm meeting a newcomer outside Pont Street. I'm meeting a newcomer outside the World Empire." She's always meeting a newcomer. The most spiritual thing you can do, I think, is meet or talking to a newcomer. So, step 11 in the book is very much about, so if the substance of the day is step 12, so higher consciousness, service within AA, service outside AA, step 11 is the means. So as soon as someone has committed to the program, however, in whatever rudimentary way, I've got a little note that I give them, say, this is what a daily program looks like. And it includes step 11, basically the instructions from page 86 to 88. So they're doing this right from the beginning. I get them to get a little coterie of pals together. I direct them towards some particular people who I sponsor, who I know are a safe pair of hands for this, and say, what you want to do is you want to run through your day, your previous 24 hours with someone, do a review. If they want you to send it, you send the review. So you do a review and you talk it through with someone else, let the corrective measures from there flow into the plan for the next day, do a plan for the day, run it past a grown-up. And to run it past someone who is going to be actively feeding back and interfering with it. It's no good having someone that's just going to say, "Oh yes, marvelous," to everything when it's not, because people don't. I didn't know how to live. I had no clue. One dumb idea after another. Someone described history as one damn thing after another. That's what my plans for the day looked like, one damn thing after another. So I needed people to say, that's a really, really bad idea. So I encourage people to find a group of, because what you don't want with your sponsees is for them to become dependent on you or to see you as some kind of sole authority. There's a tradition in AA. A friend of mine in New York was at a, I'm sure I've told this story. I've got limited numbers, so it's like a merry-go-round. All the horses come round again eventually. You just have to sit and watch it for long enough. Friend in New York was at a meeting, and the secretary didn't show up, or the chair didn't show up. The person who's going to be taking the meeting is sober, and said, "Steve, can you take the meeting tonight?" He said, "I'll just check with my sponsor." And he went over the room and went over and asked his sponsor if he could do this, if this was allowed. And the sponsor gave him this sort of papal blessing. And then he went and took the meeting. It's very established structure.
Tim, we've kind of lost you, I think. Has everybody else lost him?
Just he was describing the chair disappearing as well.
Frozen.
Yeah. This is a unique situation.
We should now ask our sponsors what to do.
Yeah. I think he's lost connection. Oh. Okay. Yeah, see, he's disappeared. Maybe he'll rejoin, hopefully.
Right, where did I lose you?
Papal blessing.
So he gave him his papal. Luckily, I've got two internet connections, so we're good. Eventually. Anyway, the point is, what you don't want is to become like the sole source, the only person they're talking to. They've got to be talking to a whole bunch of people and getting to know a bunch of people. Often, they, you know, you give them a half a dozen people to talk to. They discover they like them more and immediately switch to them as sponsors. This is good. If there's someone better, they should be with that person. You don't want to hug everyone to yourself. This is also great for your own sponsees because it gives them an opportunity to be trained on people without having like the full responsibility. So people get used to what the practice looks like without, you know, formally having these as permanent sponsees. And it shares the work around the group, really, because if you're sober a long time, you're just going to get asked a lot. So I get people to work with their evening review and their morning planning for the day, which must be integrated. So the corrective measures need to flow into the next morning's planning. I get them to run through that with some people, find the people it works well with, and then come to me with any headlines every day. What I'm discovering at the moment, I sort of stopped doing this for a while, but I think it's the best thing. Well, I may change my mind, but I think the best thing is, with anyone in the first few months, is to be calling you daily. And it doesn't need to be a protracted conversation. What I get people to do is to call daily with whatever step work they've completed in the last 24 hours, or call daily and call daily with whatever particular instruction I've given someone recently, which works very well. What's your biggest internal problem of the last 24 hours? What's your biggest external problem of the last 24 hours? And that's very helpful because it means you can feed them solutions right from the beginning. Because this is the, you know, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Some people will come to you to do a sort of academic run through the program, but they want everyone to stay out of their lives and their lives are a catastrophe. And what you don't want is to sort of wait while these, you know, catastrophes are unfurling around them, like wondering why they're so crazy. Well, it's because no one is addressing the crap that's going on. So I find that everything, if I'm doing that, what, you know, what's the biggest drama, internal drama, external drama of the last 24 hours, which you've processed, already talked to a couple of people about. So by the time it's processed with a couple of people, you get a much cleaner version than the kind of raw sewage, which, you know, comes out of people when the situation is completely fresh. If you can have fresh raw sewage, I'm not sure that's an appropriate metaphor. But anyway, you get the point. By the time they've talked to a couple of people, it's clearer already. And then you can really provide helpful direction. They know what's happened. They've figured out at least the basics. So you're integrating the program with their life right from the beginning, but you're not the sole authority. There's a whole group of people. If you've got five people telling them, you're crazy, you're approaching it, you know, this is not helping, then they'll believe it. If it's one person, it's them against you. And I've had a lot of them against me, against the sponsee in the past. When that does not happen, but there's a whole group of people they're talking to who have got their heads screwed on. They don't think that it's one person against them. It's the power of the group. But it works through there being, you know, lots of one-to-one interactions. Regarding the content of the evening and the morning routines, if people want to do their, you know, their readings and their breathing and the chanting and all of that, obviously I'm not going to disturb any of that. But the morning has to contain the plan for the day. And I get people at the beginning to do pretty strict plans for the day. And this, I think this is so important, particularly the ones who are slippery in terms of the not drinking bit of the program. Because very often what people will do is leave huge chunks of time in which the thought spontaneously then occurs to them to drink. And of course, it isn't spontaneously occurring. They specifically left a 4-hour gap between work and having to be home in order to, oh, I'll just figure something out in the moment, knowing subconsciously, but that when they get to that, oh, I feel like a drink now. And then they go and drink. My schedule when I was new was nailed down for me so that I knew at every moment of the day exactly where I was supposed to be. And there wasn't, you couldn't have squeezed a cigarette paper in between the various appointments in my schedule, let alone a full blown relapse. And my first sponsor, Doug, said that the worst thing for an alcoholic is unstructured free time. So I get people with the morning meditation to focus very much on a solid plan for the day. And sometimes I've reviewed these and that people write the most extraordinary things. I can't tell you all the wonderful things because in case the person's listening to this tape, but people can make a meal out of ordinary everyday things. I'll just leave it at that, like stuff which would take you or me 8 minutes, 4 minutes, 2 minutes. There's like a whole hour set aside, you know. So the plans are very revealing about what's actually going on for them. The other thing about the daily call, which so in the morning, by the time they get to you, hopefully they've done a nice early morning meeting. There are lots of 7 a.m. meetings around, particularly in continental Europe. There are, if you're in the UK, you can get to 8 a.m. meetings in Europe, which are 7 a.m. in the UK. There are, so hopefully they, by the time they speak to you at around 9 o'clock, they've been to a meeting. They've gone through their review from the night before. They've done a plan for the day. They've run it past a couple of people. Then you can really add value as a sponsor on the top of all of that. Also, the other thing I find with this daily calling, people are, this is kind of dog psychology thing. People are much more vulnerable in the morning in that, I don't mean in terms of woundable. I mean, they're kind of not with it enough to conceal what's going on. By the time they've got to the evening, they've been performing for 12 hours and they're these, you know, perfect representations of what someone should be. In the morning, people are just aren't with it enough to cover their tracks and listen to what people say and how they say. It's super revealing. It's not what they, it's the things they inadvertently say. It's the language they use, which reveals what's really going on. And that provides the material for the conversation most of the time. I mean, one thing which I've had in it isn't one particular person. If they're listening, you know, if you're listening and you recognize yourself, you're not the only one. It's not all about you. Someone was, a very common topic is about discipline with the program. And it does indeed in step 11 talk about God will discipline us. But when I've noticed when people say I need more discipline, the problem is a lack of enthusiasm, because when you're enthusiastic about something, you don't need discipline. And it's just like with drinking. I didn't need discipline to drink every day because I was enthusiastic about it. So someone, you know, and I think someone says it about once a week. Yeah, I need to be more disciplined about this. And of course, that won't work. Absolutely won't work, because if you could muster the discipline, you would have done it already. It's not about discipline. When people don't realize they're going to reveal anything by saying that, I have no idea, because it's an aside. It looks like it's the right thing to say. So listen, I try and listen very, very carefully. I read between the lines in those conversations. With the evening review, you go to meetings, we'll talk about doing their step 10s, and they do this long, long rehash of a step 4. And I think we talked about this last week, and I don't really do that. What I'm looking for out of the evening review is corrective measures for tomorrow. There's no point in analyzing things for the sake of analyzing it. The point is to figure out what I need to believe, think, and do differently tomorrow. That's what the key is. So where it says were we resentful? It doesn't say what were we resentful about. But almost everyone I know does an evening review. This is in the past, you know, almost, well, 28, 29 years. Almost everyone thinks it's write lots of things about all the people that bother you. No. Were you resentful? In other words, were you indulging that character defect? Ditto with fear. It doesn't say, what are you frightened about? It says, were you frightened? In other words, were you indulging the fear? And then you've got a completely different question. Because the real question then is, isn't that interesting? You know, I'll ask myself, isn't that interesting how attracted I am to finding fault with other people or things in the world? And it's always because I feel guilty or awkward or ashamed or embarrassed or inadequate in myself, which is why I'm looking for someone else whose fault it is more than mine. So the real question with resentment and fear is, what's my investment that is giving rise to this? It's never about the content. The so-called content is the blank screen onto which all of that stuff is being projected. Now, sometimes you need to do a little bit of, you know, detailed work on the content, but the danger is believing that if you get rid of the content somehow, that the resentment will go away, and it won't, because the next day, if the reason why you're resentful, which is internal, which has got to do with an internal state of mind, if that isn't resolved, you'll simply find something else the next day. And the two things which I find sort of persistent when people do these reviews is either the same thing coming up day after day after day after day on the review, or it looks like a different thing, but it's the same thing wearing a different hat. You know, so one person, it will always be people in authority who are trying to belittle them or not giving them enough credit, for instance. And every day it's a new example, and it looks like it's, can I read you my inventory? And of course, there's no new information there. And so that's why I think the focus must be getting the corrective measures on the table. And the review the following day is, how diligent were you in implementing those corrective measures? For instance, if it's fear, you know, how diligently did you recite memorized prayers about God's protection? How many times did you recite Psalm 91 today? Well, I didn't. I just sat in fear. You see, that's the problem then. It's not about the thing you're frightened of. It's the indulgence of it. So the focus I take with people on the review is very different to what most people do. It's not that other people are doing it wrong. This is just what I do. So it's all about corrective measures. And I think the corrective measures business and the sane and sound ideal. So at the end of 8 and 9, do a sane and sound ideal for each problematical area, which represents the ideals towards which we're willing to grow. And then on a daily basis, there are corrective measures for the more minute adjustments. And I think this is the engine of change. Unless I've got a vision for what I should be, I can't move towards it. So it sounds like it's step 10, but it's not, because it's the nightly review. Now then, if the corrective measures aren't being implemented, you get to the really interesting question, which is about willingness. Why isn't there the willingness to do this? What's going on? And that's when you really get to the core. Getting too involved in the so-called content of the psychological stuff, the resentments, the fears, the aversions, the attractions, getting too absorbed in the content of that, you can end up never asking the real question about willingness to change your entire point of view about everything. So that's the mistake I've made, getting super involved in the detail and then finding you're just, it's like chasing, it's like a dog chasing its tail, and you and the sponsee together form one sort of unholy dog chasing its tail. You're sort of constantly trying to get them to do the program, but there every day they come up with another, you know, wheelbarrow full of material, and you're constantly you're bailing out this wheelbarrow every day, and the next day they go and fill it up again and bring to you all the things they filled the wheelbarrow with. Now, if you don't get past the content, you can stay stuck in that for a long time. And I think that's probably classed as an Al-Anon slip to do that, to not. And of course, when you try and go beyond, people love you addressing the content. People hate getting behind it and looking at real questions of willingness to live the corrective measures. And that's how you know you're getting close to the truth, is when the real resistance comes up. And the funny thing was, there was someone I was sponsoring a few years ago, and this isn't one person, it was like several people, where they're people sober a long time, they phone up and say, can I read my inventory to you? Can I read it to you? And if I said no, they were so disappointed. I said, no, let's talk about something else. And they didn't want to do that. They wanted to, it's like that sort of, in one of the religions, I'm told, people will gain absolution and then see themselves having license to sin again because they've done the penance. And it's like, as a sponsor, you can become the person that they come to very sort of guiltily to reveal all the bad stuff they've done or thought in order to then clear the decks to go and do it again. And so I've got to be terribly careful not to become part of that system, because I've become part of the problem. My sponsor talks about the crocodile tears of insincere sincerity. And it's the same sometimes with slippers. You get this, people that relapse on repeatedly on alcohol, although the question is, are they relapsing or did they ever really stop forever? The issue is this sort of cycle, and it talks about the cycle in The Doctor's Opinion, emerging remorseful, and then they call you and then you set them going again, and then over weeks or months they drift, and then they drink again, and then it's the well-known stages of the spree, and you're just, it's like the stations of the cross, you're just one of the stops on this endless cycle. So I'm very, very alert now to being part of one of those cycles where the time in AA is the necessary penance to go back and slip again. Because then if you give AA, and this is the thing, if you give AA a really good go and you slip, it's not your fault if you slip. So you don't have to feel guilty about it because AA clearly didn't work. So some of the slippiest people are some of the best at doing the program when they come back. And this dynamic works similarly with people with lots of very, very high drama. There's a cycle of the drama escalates and escalates and escalates. And then they come to you and you process it and they're cleaned down. Everything's fine. And then it all builds from scratch again. And again, it's exactly the same as with the people who are repeatedly drinking. And so the way to get at those is to be looking at this is why the daily calling, and if someone is presenting with systemic problems, so the daily calling, I get people to call daily in their first few, when they're doing the steps for the first time, when they're coming back off a relapse, or if they're presenting systemic problems. So sort of generalized depression or anxiety or something like that after several years in AA and they've done the program, you know, six times, seven times, nine times, and they're in a bad way. And what's so interesting is that the sticking point is always the implementation of the corrective measures. It's always where the problem lies. One example is, and this is again not one particular person, it's lots of people I've seen over the years, where if the solution is step 12 and really engaging in step 12, and the problem is this sort of relentless return into self-obsession and old mental patterns of victimhood and blame and self-pity and self-indulgence and all of those. I speak from experience here. My first 16 years were not pretty. The solution is step 12. And if you just tell people and they totally buy that. You spend a week, you know, preparing for that launch into step 12. Unless it's then monitored daily, it just drifts away. And what's so interesting, when I get people on a thing where they call every day with what their step 12 stuff is, you find out very quickly that even a week later, the enthusiasm has waned for the step 12 stuff and corners are being cut straight away. And you can hold people to what they agreed they were doing just by looking at it on a daily basis. And then eventually it's like holding a plant in new soil. And you kind of have to, what the plant wants to do is pull up its roots and run away. And it's like you're holding the plant there until the roots take, and then the roots take, and then they're fine. But there is a period where, and I, this was done with me, where you need to be held to it. And I do it daily. My sponsor was doing it weekly, just because of his schedule. So I prefer 5 minutes. I'd rather have 5 minutes a day than 1 hour a week. But it's this daily cycle. It's being part of that daily cycle where people get to reveal what's not working, have corrective measures and implement them. I think that's the powerhouse of the whole thing. And without someone else intimately on the inside of that process, it tends not to. Some people are self-basting chickens. They're absolutely fine. They're up and running. Other people will have a tendency to close back in on themselves and go back into the old patterns. And it's with those people that I find it most useful to do that daily business with. So that's all I got on step 11. So I'll hand it back to you, Alistair, to see if there are any questions from our dazed onlookers.
Thank you very much, Tim. The meeting is now open for questions for Tim, which can be done by the raised hand function in Zoom, or you can message me through the chat function and I will ask Tim directly. And if all else fails, please wave your hand at the camera and I will try to get you. And we normally try to close on the hour, but it's very informal, so we may run past. And with that, I'll open it up for questions. Harry.
Hey everyone, I'm Harry, I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Tim. This could be a bit of a sprawling one, apologies. So you talked a little bit I'd say less than half of my sponsees have even said they're even willing to do just what it says in the book. They'll always tag things on and turn it into mindfulness meditation, all sorts of stuff. And like you said, so my approach is, okay, well, you can do whatever you like, you know, in addition, as long as you're giving the core stuff here a fair go. So the question is really about, but all of them say it's about the point. What's the point of step 11? It says it's about improving our conscious contact with God. So how do you know if what you're doing is improving your conscious contact with God? Because actually, I don't think this is unfair. People will say, well, it's maybe with mindfulness meditation, for example, in my case, it gave me a better ability to see my thoughts as distinct things that were separate from me. So that's one material benefit. You know, most of the time it makes me feel better. I have a bliss out and I feel floaty. And that's how they evaluate it as being a good sort of step 11 thing. But none of them have been like, as part of my step 11, I did a IT course, you know, to make me more useful at work, or, you know, so how do you evaluate whether something's improving your conscious contact with God?
What a lot of questions. I've written some of them down. So now what's the point is an I think that needs to be covered first. You see, I'm going to go against everything I said and start quoting A Course in Miracles here. So, you know, there we go. But there's a section of Course in Miracles, which is one of the more practical ones. You know how some of those sections about lilies are not necessarily super obvious how you apply them. But there's a section called Rules for Decision. What the basic gist is this. You can't make any decision without a guide. Now, the guide is either your ego or it's the higher power. So you get to pick one. If you don't actively pick the higher power, because the ego is always there and the ego always answers first, you will be following your ego. You can't not make decisions because you have to live. You have to have a day. So you're going to be making decisions. The only question is, where are you going to get the decisions from? So what's the point of step 11 is to seek direction from your higher power rather than from your ego. Why would you want to do that? Because the ego can only bring fear, frustration, disappointment, and despair. That's fear, frustration, disappointment, and despair, because the purpose of the ego is to establish for me a separate identity in the material world as exhibited by the material form that we appear to inhabit, and then to make that identity and form special in some way. And if you look at the material world, it's notoriously difficult to make a name for yourself on a planet with 8 billion people, and it's notoriously difficult to achieve any sort of permanence for yourself when you are made 90% of water on a planet where water evaporates at room temperature. People are very squashable and evaporatable. The ego's plans are all about trying to secure some kind of eternal value from a place which is endlessly dangerous and mutable, whether it's materially or in terms of reputation and things like that. It's got to be understood in step 3 that the ego-based life, I'm not making this up, this is directly from the book, a life run on self-will can hardly be a success. There we go. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest happiness and satisfaction from this world if he only manages well? So it's based on the idea, hopefully the idea is bought, that you're on a hiding to nothing with the ego. So the smart money is to go with the higher power. And once that idea is understood, then you've got a basis for explaining what is step 11. Step 11 is the process by which you actively, deliberately, consciously, manually override your ego and go straight to the boss. You kind of want to be a Karen. I shouldn't say Karen with Karen W here, but you know that the dreadful meme in America of the Karen who says, "I want to see the manager." You want to be a Karen here. You want to be like Karen. You want to see the manager. You want to see the boss. You don't want to palm yourself. You don't want to fob yourself off with your ego. You want to go straight to the boss, get the good stuff from behind the counter. So that's the point of step 11, is to insist, is to develop, is to take your sense of entitlement and say, I'm entitled to the best possible guidance for my life in order to make the best possible decisions to have the best possible outcome, which is peace. I'm entitled to that. Give it to me. And that's super helpful because it's taking what looks like a character defect, which is belligerence and entitlement, and turning them into virtues. So you're fighting not against something, but for what is your inheritance, which is a much better life. Bob Olson is an AA speaker from Colorado. I want to say Inglewood, Colorado. Is that a place? Anyway, I think he's from there. On the site, it will say, you know, so and so from so and so, because there are lots of Bob this is and Bob that. So Bob Olson from Colorado, or maybe Littleton. I don't know. Anyway, he's very good on this. He says, if you honestly want to seek your higher power's will, and you take the actions of asking, you better bet your bottom dollar that what comes down the tubes to you is more likely to be God's will than if you just run on automatic. And I think any experience of step 11 will prove this, that even if you don't get the knowledge during the day, you're more sensitized to ideas which are not ordinarily your own. Stuff that other people say is just going to bother you more. It gets in, like it wears away the varnish. How do you know it's worked? There are two ways. Well, actually, there are three ways. There are four ways. The list is growing as we speak. So the first way is to listen to the tone of the voice. So if the action indicated through the step 11 process is about fear, Resentment, guilt, shame, brackets, sin would be the traditional word for shame, the sense of there being something wrong with you in addition to having done something wrong. Fear, resentment, guilt, shame, attraction and aversion. Those are the six you want to look out for. If it's to do with those, then you might want to be suspicious. I behaved very badly on one particular protracted occasion about 11 years ago. And I wasn't telling my sponsor that there was dirty work afoot. And when I finally revealed the situation, which I'm not going to go into here, when I finally revealed the content of the situation to my sponsor, I said, I'm now kind of stuffed because I don't know whether to, like, you're saying I should go to God, but I've been going to God throughout this whole thing. And I genuinely thought I was doing the right thing. He said, did you pray for the good of all? And I suddenly realized, no. And that's a really good test. So on one hand, is it based on fear, resentment, guilt, shame, attraction, or aversion? Or is it based on acting for the good of all, which is dovetails beautifully with tradition one and unity and common welfare. And when I think of all of my little sort of emotional jags, which have resulted in behavior, which I thought was justified, often in the service structure, I've been an absolute ogre. When I apply that test retrospectively, was I acting out of one of those six or was I acting for the good of all? Oh, I always had an angle when I was behaving badly. So I think it's a terribly good test. It is looking at what the tone of it is. Does it come from a place of goodness or does it come from a place of one of the other ones? You can always compare it to the principles of the program. So this is the second thing. Does it accord with the principle in the big book? If so, which page is it on? Which principle? Which line? Give us the quotation. Very helpful. Particularly if you take chapters 8 and 9 as guides to interacting with other people, and you extract the principles from there and test your proposed course of action against those 7, 8, and 9, actually chapters 7, 8, and 9. That's really helpful. You run it past a grown-up. Now don't run it past 7 grown-ups because you won't get a quorum probably, and then you just end up picking the one that you are going to do anyway. So have a couple of super trusted grown-ups to push these things past. That's 3 things. How do you tell if it's God's will? 4th thing is you have to try it out and see if it works or not. And if it doesn't work, you admit it promptly. And you find out pretty quickly, usually. So I think that combination of looking at the tone of the voice behind it, that like the intent behind it, comparing it to principle, running it past a grown up and, try it out. See what happens, and you get a pretty good view there. Emotional state, so transcendental states are not necessarily a good sign that you've actually contacted, that you're in contact with God's will. Very often, God's will comes in the form of a very uncomfortable awareness of where one is going wrong, like super uncomfortable. It's different than guilt and shame, which are kind of self-indulgent morasses that one can swim around in and are kind of attractive in some way. That it's just this gnawing awareness that one's got it wrong and one needs to do it differently. That's the best test. It's, oh my God, I've got this wrong for 7 years. What I really ought to be doing is speaking in single sentences as opposed to, James Joyce novels, for instance. Yeah. So anyway, I hope that's covered your questions, Harry.
Can I just respond by quickly saying, because I find it quite interesting that so in the step sorry in the big book step 11, in the 12 and 12 step 11, even in the appendix 2 spiritual, not once does it say this is going to feel good. It says we ask to be, save us from self-pity, but it doesn't ever Now, I feel pretty good a lot of the time, but it doesn't say, you know, you are really going to be floating here. It never really seems to give me that sense at all. So there we go.
Absolutely, yeah.
Seamus.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Tim. Lots of food for thought there. I want to go back to ground that you covered in the first 5-10 minutes about alternative belief systems. Can you work with the grain of that or not? I haven't had too much trouble with people having religious beliefs. I can think of one guy who thought he was born again, and that kind of gave him a free pass on most what you might call, what you might have called the spiritual side of the program, and it was the kind of born again church where God wants his people to be prosperous, so it comes with goodies, so you could sort of go to church and pray for goodies. And that maybe brings me to the bigger point, the nub of the question, which is the kind of new age belief that you can manifest things and attract things through the power of positive thinking. I find this is very widespread in AA. One hears it sort of alluded to in meetings. And it's not just a new age thing. It has its roots in the power of positive thinking, which appears to have deep roots in American culture. You know, the idea that if you want to achieve something, you have to vision it positively, and then you will kind of like get it. Now, I can see how negative thinking will attract negative things, and I think the spirit of that is in step 11. You know, what you said about resentment, dishonesty, fear, and selfishness. But it's never been clear to me that the converse is true, that one can somehow conjure into existence positive goodies by thinking more positively about them. How does one deal with that? Enough of question.
I once went to a sponsor. I said to him, a friend of mine was going through some sort of difficult time, and I said to my sponsor, "What should I do?" And my sponsor said, "Hide, just hide." And that was very good advice, in fact. The individual in question is now sort of a famous editor and journalist and columnist. So everything turned out well in the end. But anyway, I find all that stuff a bit disagreeable, really, to put it mildly. However, there's a little bit of Emmett Fox which touches on things like that. What's his name? Norman Vincent Peale. And I think there's more, I've used both extensively, and I think there is more good than ill in both. But I think it's a very banal and ridiculous application of that principle to turn it into, you know, sort of Ferraris and swimming pools and promotions. I'm absolutely convinced that my life is chiefly limited by my limited perception of it. And to have those limitations lifted by envisioning a much more expansive, interesting life, I think is absolutely the solution. But I think it must be applied to more abstract commodities like kindness and diligence and interest and curiosity and all those sort of virtues that, you know, I find it very easy to write myself off as a sort of bag of character defects bumbling through the world like the castle in Howl's Moving Castle. You know, it works, but it's not elegant. But actually, I've held myself back by not visualizing that I could be different, that I could be a more expansive, a kinder and a more useful person. What your question reminds me of a lot of what Anthony de Mello writes about taking perfectly sound spiritual principles and making a complete mockery of them by running them through the materialistic framework. So there's a wonderful Anthony de Mello story about ants and their conception of God, and how some very learned ants argue about, they all agree that when we go to the other realm, when the ants go to the higher realm, that they're going to if they've lost their sting during their life, the sting will be restored, but the question is whether they have two stings or three or something like that. So that their theological framework is limited by the fact that they're ants, and their conception of God is limited by, so they can only imagine God as an ant but bigger than them. And I think it's the same as if you've got a materialistic framework and you grab hold of spiritual principles without sufficient training and dismantling of the materialistic structure, you'll simply recreate yourself using the, you'll assimilate, like the Borg, you'll assimilate the so-called spirituality into your existing framework. Whereas, of course, if you get rid of that framework and then you adopt the spirituality, you're getting a clean version of it. I had a sponsee, I don't think he'll mind me saying this, but he's rather sort of amusing about the whole thing. And he did the whole manifesting thing for a couple of years, and I sort of left him alone with it, because he didn't really ask me anything about it, just did it. And he came to me after a couple of years, he said, it was a whole load of bullshit, isn't it? I said, yes. But he had to go through it and try it and realise that it's all sort of ridiculous. I think he was trying to manifest a career and it just didn't happen. So I don't get too involved in it, because if people are very bought into it, there's nothing you can say or do, but I just gently point them towards pages 60 and 61, and that seems to send them running for the hills, or they just never talk about it to me again. So I don't know if that answers your question at all.
Thanks, Tim. Anyone else have a question for Tim? I've also dropped in the link to the Google Drive where you can find the recordings from these previous meetings.
I just say one more thing about that. It's true with the manifesting thing, it's true with other things, is people are at liberty to do whatever they want, but one's got to recognize what the program says. And and on 87, it talks very clearly about not praying for selfish ends, and you can only pray if other people will be helped. So you can point out, you said, well, you do what you want, but you be aware that it is the opposite of what the AA program is suggesting. And you get to pick, but don't think that just because what you're doing comes under a spiritual or religious heading, it's necessarily compatible with the program. That's a point that I think is worth making to people.
Can I just ask one more quick one? So you just fired something up for me. So I think a lot of the confusion or the difference in approach to step 11, whether you stick very close to the big book or you go totally off piece and stuff, is down to a sort of idea that, well, the program is what you choose it to be. So where are you at with that? So you're quite big booky. But it's not our job to convince anyone that's the case, right? You can take it or you can do something else. Is that where you're at?
Oh, I'm going to say something so awful. No one will talk to me again after this. Unfortunately, the program was devised by specific people at a specific time in a specific context with a specific purpose. And unfortunately, they established that as being the AA program. They wrote it and they were pretty clear. They were unclear about certain things. It's as Alan G says, that it's clear up to a point. It's clear what it's clear about, but it's silent on many things and leaves a lot of things to people's own discretion. Like the exact form of step 5 does not tell you how to do it. It gives you general principles. Other things, it's super, super, super specific. But in as far as they've written it down, that is what they agreed one way or another. It was a messy process, but essentially it reflects what they believe the program was. And the program came before the fellowship and came before the book. Now, if someone does something else, that may work better, but it's not the AA program. It's a kind of version of it. It's their own version of it. And that's not a bad thing, but it is. I don't think you can say this is the AA program when it's radically. Now, people have their own takes on things, their own versions of things. Everyone does the big book slightly differently. So there's obviously huge amounts of variation within that. But things which are radically different, I'll give you an example of one, if I may. There was a woman in Al-Anon many years ago who said, who read off the steps on the wall. Step five, the exact nature of our wrongs. Well, those are the wrongs that were done to me. So in my step five, I told someone else all the terrible things that had ever been done to me. And that was step five. Now, she's done a step, but it's not Al-Anon's step five. It's her step five. It may be better than Al-Anon's step five, but it's not Al-Anon's step five. So I'm skeptical about relabeling things the AA steps when they're not. And that's why I'm kind of big booky, really. And the reason why I'm big booky is because it actually is not doctrinal. It's just because it's what I found to work better than anything else. And if something else worked better, I would be doing it, and you'd have a different speaker this evening. So that's what I've got on that.
Thanks, Tim. Claire.
Hi there. I'm sorry. I guess we're running out of time. So a question would be, would you see there being any risk of the Course in Miracles sort of unraveling the 12-step program in a way, when a person can go very far into the course? And at what point must you put down the course?
Good question. Listen to Ken Wapnick about this. He's absolutely brilliant and completely scathing, actually. If you think I'm scathing, listen to Ken Wapnick talk about the Course in Miracles students, about how disconcerting it is when you're out for dinner with Course in Miracles students and they try and pray to the Holy Spirit or to Jesus as to whether to have the chicken entree or the beef. And of course, from the Course in Miracles perspective, God is unaware of the existence of the material world. So to ask God whether you should have chicken or beef is neither here nor there. And what he's very clear about, and this is brilliant, this is just brilliant because it applies to all spiritual paths, is make a distinction between the metaphysical and the physical. These are different realms. So whatever metaphysical understanding you have, they inform each other. The two realms inform each other, but do not get them confused. So when you say, well, nothing is real, it's all an illusion, everything is a projection of the ego mind. Yes, it is. But still brush your teeth, have a dental hygienist, get a pension, be nice to other people, even though it's only their ego that's affected. You still get to try and be nice to them, 6 days out of seven. So not to mix the two levels. So if you don't mix the two levels, you keep the AA program first and you go to a shed load of meetings and look out for new people and ask them if they've stopped shaking yet, then I think you're minimizing the risk that you'll disappear so far up yourself that no one ever sees you again.
Thanks, Tim. And with that, I think I'll hand the meeting back to you and ask you to close with the Serenity Prayer.
As opposed to a prayer from A Course in Miracles. Absolutely. So would you help me close with the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity.
To accept things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can,
and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Tim. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Good to see you all.
Yeah, good to see you. Do you have a meeting starting now?
It's what?
Do you have a meeting starting now?
It's not a meeting, it's a kind of gathering, but we sort of start about 15, quarter past, 20 past.
Yeah, okay, I was just wondering, actually. I was wondering every week there is something afterwards. I know, I didn't know if it was a meeting or, but it's an illegal gathering, you say.
Yeah, it's like an illegal rave we have.
Okay, I'll let you get on with it.
And then we ask for corrective measures.
Yeah.
All right, God bless.
Right, see you, Seamus and Daniel.
Bye. See you, Seamus.
Bye.
20 past, Alistair.
Yeah. Is that all right?
Probably see you then.
All right, good. See you in a bit. Oh, I've got to stop recording, God.